said I would.
Blog Talk Radio.
Here we go. My music's gonna come up.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a book, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge with a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the air.
Good morning, everyone. This is Fran Lewis. I'm your host. This is MJ Network. MJ stands for my sister who I miss every day, Marcia Joyce. And this is going to be fun. And the sun is shining. It's beautiful outside, and you don't even need a jacket. It's perfect. So I'm going to just make one short announcement because I promise. My niece, Pammy Purcell, is sponsoring through Manhattan Hill Hospital. We're so delighted to try to keep these animals alive. We're so delighted to announce the date, which is Sunday, the 7th Paws to Love and Pet Adoption Festival for shelter animals and rescue groups. So if you're around the Manhattan Hill Animal Hospital and you've always wanted a rescue dog, this would be a fantastic time to go. There'll be music, vendors, family activities, and, of course, pets to adopt. Several rescues have already been confirmed, and I'm really proud of her that she's doing this, and I promised I would announce it since it is on Sunday. And now I am totally excited. We have the author of One Small Sacrifice, Hillary Davidson, here. And good morning. How are you? And I'm glad you're here.
Oh, good morning. I'm glad to be here. I'm in the middle of the tour right now, which is a little crazy, but I am so excited to be talking to you.
Well, could you tell us a little bit about your book and a little bit of a plot summary? And I'm going to post it with 17 stars later, I promise.
Oh, that is absolutely wonderful. Thank you. Well, One Small Sacrifice is my fifth novel, but it's the first book in a new series. It's a little bit different from a series, from a usual series book, though, because the story is told from multiple viewpoints. So you have the viewpoint of the main suspect in the story, a man named Alex Trainer, who's a war photographer who has PTSD. And when the book begins, his girlfriend, actually his fiancée, has gone missing. She's been missing for a couple of days. And Alex is a little concerned about her, but, you know, feels like, well, she left me a note and wants time off on her own. So that's okay. But when you switch to the perspective of Sharon Sterling, the NYPD detective who's investigating the case, now her suspicions are immediately triggered because Alex has been on her radar for a year. Before the book began, a year earlier, a female friend of his fell off the roof of his building when she was alone up there with him. And the police were very, they were suspicious, they investigated, but there were drugs involved. Alex was never charged with a crime, but there's sort of a certain wariness about him and an understanding that this is a man with problems. And, you know, this is maybe someone who's responsible for some terrible things. And so as soon as Sharon Sterling, as soon as this case comes in and she understands that the fiancé has gone missing, she fears the worst. And so there's sort of the mystery set in, present day where, obviously looking for this missing woman, but you're also trying to unravel the mystery of what happened a year earlier. And the two cases are tied together. So you're really trying to unravel two mysteries as the book goes on.
I know one. I was wanted to ask this question, and I do once in a while. Why is it that some authors like to write in different point of views? I mean, I understand everything, and sometimes what I do, this is going to sound really weird, is that I'll read all of Sharon, then I'll read all of Alex, then I'll read all of the other ones after I read the whole book, so that I make sure that I get their point of view. So how come authors write in that type of style? Because I've been getting a lot of books like that, not as many as well written as this one, seriously, because sometimes I go like, why are you doing this to me? And you're torturing my life, I'm a reading and writing specialist. I was a staff developer and dean, and sometimes I need to pull out the graphic organizer and put the person's name at the top to see what they're writing. Seriously,
right.
That's that. That's not a good sign.
Right. Yeah. Well, that is such a great question because, so this is my fifth novel, and this is a complete departure for me because this is not the style that I wrote my earlier books in.
Mm-hmm.
My first three books were part of a different series, the Lily Moore series, and all of the stories were told from Lily's first person point of view. And so you are inside that character's head. You're with her for every moment of those books. And wrote a book afterwards that was a standalone, and there were three perspectives, but they were sequential. You weren't switching from one perspective to another.
Mm.
There was one character that told part of the story, and then it moved to the next, and then the third one. So I will say, so the appeal for this for me was that the main thing that interests me when I write a book is the character's psychology. And in this case, there were four characters whose point of view is represented, like a close third-person point of view, so the reader's inside their heads. And it would be kind of a spoiler to mention who one of those characters is, so I won't do that.
Mm-hmm.
But the three I'll talk about, so you're inside Alex's head. So you're inside the head of the main suspect, and I really wanted people to sort of see the world as he sees it. And so at the very beginning of the book, he has a PTSD episode when he's on basically an almost empty street in Manhattan, and I wanted people to sort of to feel what that was like and to be with him so you understand him, even if there were things about the character, you know, you might not like as you read more, and things about him that that are troubling. That, you know, this is no character in the book would be a fully good character or fully bad character. Everyone exists in a shade of gray, and everyone sort of has their own justification for what they do. And so, for instance, when you switch from Alex's point of view to Sharon's point of view, she's a terrific cop. She's smart. She's dedicated. She's determined. But, you know, a couple of people do point out to her, like, do you have a vendetta? Are you going after this guy for a reason?
Mm-hmm.
And I wouldn't describe her. She's not someone with a vendetta, but she has family experience with PTSD. As, you know, you find out fairly early on, her father was a soldier. He served in the Army. He came back with PTSD, and it was something that upended her family. And so she's got this sort of, like an emotional, like a gut understanding of how bad things can get when someone, especially, you know, someone isn't receiving treatment and someone's self-diagnosing with drugs and someone is sort of not managing their condition the way Alex is. So you get inside her head and you realize why she's sometimes willing to do these kind of unorthodox things. You know, there are some times when she goes beyond the lines in her investigation. And then you also get a little bit of the point of view of the superintendent of the building, who I don't think it's a spoiler to say he's a creep. You know,
he's
a guy who does some really, really creepy things and is kind of like a stalker. He's someone who has behaved very inappropriately with, you know, using his access into his female tenants' apartments. But even him, I want readers to sort of understand what's going through his head, and because he really probably does more to send the police in the wrong direction in the investigation than anyone. And, you know, I wanted people to really understand, like, even with this creepy guy, even with this bad guy, when you're inside his head, you understand sort of the justifications and the reasons why somebody would do what they do. Because I don't think anybody ever wakes up in the morning and thinks, I'm going to be evil today. I think people, you know, they're pushed along by, you know, not just personality, but things that have happened in the past and their fears and all of these things sort of, you know, go together hand in hand, especially when somebody's making bad decisions or not even a decision, having a gut reaction. So the exciting thing was to be able to represent these different points of view. I will tell you, I love that you actually went back and read, like, all of Sharon's chapters, all of Alex's chapters. Because when I was writing it, though, I do that. And it's the first time I've been forced to use like a series of like index cards to follow a character storyline.
Uh-huh.
Because what you realize, so the upside to telling a story this way is that you don't have the downtime that you do when you're just following one character. Like I found with my first books, you know, not every moment is an exciting moment. Like, not every moment, you know, sometimes a character just, you know, there's kind of a lull in the action, and you're still with that character when there's a lull in the action. And when you switch from point of view to another point of view, there's always something going on. And so the pacing feels, it's fast, it's exciting. I think it pulls the reader in just because when you switch point of view, there's always something exciting going on with that next character. But I will tell you, it is definitely the toughest time I've ever had writing a book. And at the very end, I was so excited that I had done it. I was excited, like, oh, I felt like I did what I set out to do. Like, you know, this is an accomplishment. Glad I don't have to do that again. And because when I first wrote this book, I was thinking of it as a standalone. And then when my editor made an offer on the book, she was like, oh, we want a whole series like this. This is great. So I started myself, like, I'm going to have to write more books like this. That I felt like it was breaking my brain while I was doing this, and definitely a huge challenge. And I've written the second book in the series, and we're going through edits right now. So, sort of hoping at some point I'll find it easier to do. But it's tough. I think it makes a reader work harder to be inside all of those different people's minds, because when you're a reader and you're getting into the story and you're sinking into it, you know, you like to follow a character. You like to see the world, you know, through this set of eyes. And it's a more stressful thing, I think, to have that switching. So there's got to be a good reason for it. There's got to be sort of a way you're upping the ante and making the book more exciting to justify it. Because honestly, it's, you know, it's more work for the reader and more work for the writer to do it this way.
No, I agree with you, because sometimes when that happens, you say to yourself, okay, you just ended the chapter with that. Now, wait a minute, who is this person and where did this person come from? And does it coordinate?
Right.
Yeah. And I think the worst one is when I get these books, and I get so many of them, that I'm reading the paragraph and I'm saying, now, wait a minute, how did they get to the past? Who is this person? Then
right.
10 seconds later, it's another tense, and I'm going like, huh? And that's when I say, do I really have to be tortured in reading? And I get it. I get everything the person's saying. But when they switch characters in the middle of a page and don't tell you who it is, and I have to guess, I go like, huh? It's painful.
Yeah. That feels, honestly, like someone doing that kind of thing, that feels like kind of sloppy, right? Like if someone's sort of just switching in the middle of a page, and that's, I don't know. I feel like there's an art to doing it well, and it shouldn't be like a big question mark for the reader when you switch characters. One of the reasons I liked doing this was that it meant that you got, you know, the NYPD detectives, Sharon Sterling's impression of Alex Trainer, and you got his impression of her, and like you could actually see these characters. So in Alex's case, you know, when you're with him, he seems reasonable, he seems like a nice guy in a lot of ways. And then when you switch to the superintendent's perspective, even though that guy's creepy, you see Alex, though, in a whole different light. You realize how big he is and how, like, kind of aggressive he can be. And there's sort of when you have a different set of eyes on these characters, you notice different things that when you're inside their heads with them, like, you're just along for the ride and accepting what they do, and it makes you question things a little bit more. So I feel like it should be work, but it should never have people scratching their heads and saying, what time period are we in now, and who is this, and, you know, it's just, like, because that's just confusing. I hate it when I have to go back 100 pages to figure out, like, where am I in a book now? Like, that's just, you know, I feel like the writer owes it to the reader to, you know, to make these things clear and, you know, to bring them along for the ride. It shouldn't feel like painful work each time you flip to a new chapter.
It's even worse when I have to reread the book from the beginning. And I get everything.
Yeah.
I have a photographic memory, and I remember everything. And I'm going like, did I really read this? Am I really? That's what happens when, if it takes me more than a day or two to read a whole book like yours or any book, then you're in trouble. You're really in trouble.
Right.
Because that means that,
right.
that I put the book down and said, I feel like I'm going through root canal again, and that's not worth it. So we've got...
Yeah.
Seriously.
No, it's true. Like, and because you know, anyone who's reading intensely like that, there was a great piece recently in the New York Times about, you know, why people should read more and kind of, you know, pack more reading in, because you sort of, you get like the twists, the turns, almost like the in-jokes and the callbacks and things like that in the book. But I mean, if you're reading a book in a day and it's not pulling you in, you keep feeling pushed out of a book, then, you know, something isn't
That's
working.
Bad.
Like, I'm at the point now in my life, I used to read, if I started a book, I finished a book. And that was my rule for years. And
yeah,
that's really
do.
Changed. Like, in the, do you really? I no. In the last few years, I've just decided, like, no, you know what? You know, if I feel this isn't going well and I'm, you know, 100 pages in, I will, you know, give it up. I'll say that's it. You know, I know by now it's not for me, but I still admire anyone with the fortitude who sticks with it, because I did that for a long time.
No, I do it only if it's a book that I promise to review. I think
in the
10 years that I've been doing this, and I got involved before my sister died, she convinced me to do this when I retired from teaching, and she used to edit my books and everything. She's not here anymore, so that's why I named the station MJ Network after her. But I think two or three times I emailed a publicist and said, if I write a review, I don't write negative reviews. I may not always give 5 stars, but I won't write anything negative. I don't feel it's my place to pan somebody's work. So I'll give, you know, like 3.5 to 4 stars. If it's less than that, I'll just write a summary of the book, and I won't post it on Amazon. I'll just post it on my review site. And that happened twice, but only once during a novel with a police investigation that was so off base that I said, if I write something, I'm going to ask him where he got his knowledge. How do you have the wife of a retired police officer in a hole taking the bones out and handing them to this guy that wasn't even on the case? And I was like,
oh, wow.
Huh? Yeah, it was really, and I said, I've never done that. And I never even finished. That's the first time ever I never finished the book. So we have Corey Stanton. What was her relationship to Alex? And tell us about Emily. Poor Emily.
Sure. So Alex, let's see. So his friend Corey Stanton is the friend who died in the fall from the roof of his building a year before the book begins. And she's someone who, in a way, it's, you know, kind of sad that her perspective can't be represented in the book, because, of course, she's already dead. But she's someone who, you know, kind of like a kind of person who's easily written off by the police. She's like a, you know, struggling actress and model who does like to party and takes drugs. And, you know, it's the sort of person, there's another officer who's new to the squad. It's Sharon's new partner who she's filling in about the case early on, and he makes all of these assumptions. He's sort of, you know, his assumption is that, oh, like, they, you know, maybe it was a booty call, and it's like, no, Alex and Corey are just friends. Like, there's nothing romantic between them, and, you know, the assumption that men and women can't be friends and there must always be something sexual is, you know, a bad assumption. And then, like, he sort of makes his assumptions, like, oh, you know, using these drugs, and, oh, she tried to kill herself in the past. Like, oh, she probably just jumped off the roof. And, you know, because people have a certain history, you know, in life, I think, you know, there's a kind of shorthand that we use where you think, like, oh, well, this person's, you know, done certain things. I'm putting them in this box. You know, this is a party person. It's not a serious person. You know, it's, oh, well, they died. Well, that's too bad. But, you know, you just kind of write it off. And you realize, like, there are, you know, so many people are sort of not taken seriously, and they're sort of like, well, it's a victim of a crime, but look at the way they were living. You know, they kind of deserve to be a victim. Not that anyone deserves it, but it was inevitable. And I hate that. I feel like every victim should be looked at seriously and, you know, seriously considered and respected. And certainly when Emily disappears, you know, very different character. So Alex's fiance is someone he actually met in a war zone. So I mentioned that he was a war photographer. Emily is a doctor who's worked in battlefield. She's worked with the group Doctors Without Borders, who go into, you know, the worst of the worst areas and, you know, help people there. So They actually met on the battlefield. She's highly respected. She's a surgeon at a New York hospital. And so when she goes missing, it's an entirely different reaction to, you know, party girl falling off the roof. Really, Sharon Sterling is the only person who took that death very seriously. So when Emily goes missing, it's, you know, a whole different reaction. Suddenly it's like, oh, yes, you know, this doctor who's, you know, an important, credible person has gone missing, and so this really has to be investigated. And Emily is someone who certainly, like, a well-meaning person, an altruistic person, a person who tries to do good in the world, but as I mentioned earlier, there are no perfectly good characters or perfectly bad characters. You know, there are some things that she's been hiding. There are some things that, you know, Alex finds out about her just before she leaves. They've had a fight about some of the stuff he's found out, and I won't go into it because, you know, at the beginning of the book there was a fight. You don't know the details, and I don't want to give spoilers. But, you know, this is someone who comes across maybe as she's just, you know, she's perfect. She's a good person, and she is a good person. That's not in question. But even, you know, good people have secrets, and good people have things they're trying to hide. And, you know, there's not everybody wants every facet of their life, you know, on view. And so she's kind of a secretive person. And so, yeah, so it's kind of funny. In a way, they're a little bit, I don't want to say, it's not like a mirror image, but, you know, Corey is someone who'd be written off as a bad person, like this druggy, you know, actress. And Emily is someone who'd be looked at as like, oh, like a very virtuous person. She's this, you know, doctor who helps others in war zones and, you know, works for charities. And, you know, even in New York, she's helping poor people who need help. But, like, that's not all a person is. There's always a much more complex view. And I feel like in crime fiction, you're kind of given this this way to explore that, because I find in crime fiction, readers are interested in reading about everybody. You know, it's not just sort of like, oh, well, you know, this is a good character, so I want to know more about them. People want to know about the bad characters, too. People want to know about the troubled characters and get to the roots of things. So so I feel like, you know, writing crime fiction is kind of a great way to explore characters like these and to explore that gray zone.
I agree with you. And this is, I write in the first person. This way I don't have to do dialogue ever. It just makes life so much easier.
It is lovely being inside one character's head. I will say now I'm definitely missing that. I did that with my first three books, and I miss that.
No, I write from the point of view of the dead body behind the gravestone, so I kill off a couple of people in my books. Each one's different.
Wow.
Each one's tell their story. When my sister died, I went to the cemetery, and I said, if you could tell me what really happened, what would you say? And then I said to all the other people there, and I didn't know, I said, are you here because you were good? Or are you here because you did something wrong and you deserve to be here? Then I decided to write my Faces Behind the Stone series, and I'm excited because I'm hoping if they send me the cover for book 5 is supposed to come out July 1st. And it's called Silent Voices.
How's that? I have to apologize because I have not read your books, but this makes me want to read them so much. I love that idea. That is absolutely fascinating.
Really,
how often have we said, like, in fiction, like, if only the dead
it's
could
different.
Speak? Right?
Yeah.
Like, that's something, you know, if only you could have that perspective, if only you knew the real story and could see it through their eyes. That's a really beautiful idea.
It was just different, and four of the stories are based on real-life events. I won't say which ones. And three,
really?
Totally my warped imagination. But, yeah, there was teacher in my school that was wrongly accused for the first book, and I said she died and she committed suicide. And she was one of the people that I worked with for a long time. And when I heard the whole story from her before she died, I said, I'm going to write her story in my book. And I did. I wrote it exactly the way she told me. And
yeah.
I just felt that there was, like, something to it. And the other stories, too, were just made up. But this one was real. And it really happened. I changed the name and everything. But, yeah. So we have C.J. Leeward. And when Alex is being questioned, why did he need him there? I liked Alex, though,
right.
in my own little way. I liked him, though. even though he's evil.
Oh, good. Oh, I'm glad to hear that. So one of the things, so Alex, so he's been, the first couple of days when Emily vanished, there was a note that was left behind. It's a typewritten note, which Alex, you know, didn't really think anything about, but the police certainly think that's interesting that your girlfriend only left you an unsigned note, like that was, you know, printed up, you know, on a computer. And so Alex's first instinct is that, well, you know, C.J. Leeward is Emily's best friend. So he's just going to sort of go to him as a friend and say, you know her better than anybody. You've known her, you know, so much of her life. Tell me what's going on with her. And CJ isn't able to do that. They have a conversation where CJ's, you know, kind of aware that there have been some strange things going on, but Emily hasn't confessed anything to him. He doesn't have a handle on it. But at the same time, while this conversation's going on, the police are actually in Alex's apartment and finding blood on the rug in the apartment. And so CJ is a lawyer, and criminal law isn't his specialty, but he basically ends up working as Alex's lawyer. He'd helped Alex in the past, a year earlier, when, you know, he'd been brought in for questioning and kind of extensively questioned by the police. Because, you know, CJ being close to Emily, you know, helped out Alex, and he's a phenomenally talented lawyer. He works in immigration, and so he is actually familiar with criminal law and other types of law. It sort of all touches on what he does normally. So, you know, he is kind of like a strong, steady presence, but at the same time, as the book goes on, you realize, you know, he's keeping things back. He's not lying to Alex about anything. He really doesn't know where Emily's gone or what's happened. But you start to understand that, you know, there, in sort of the friendship that he has with Emily and the relationship with her, that he does know more than he's telling, and that, you know, sometimes you have divided loyalties. You know, you want to help, and, you know, Alex sort of says, like, well, you know, can I tell you this thing that's bothering me, this thing that we were fighting about? And CJ basically says, you know, if I act as your lawyer, I can represent you, but I can't represent Emily in absentia. So if you tell me anything, you know, that's bad or illegal, I actually have a duty to report it to the police. So there's a limit to the honesty that the two of them can have with each other. And, you know, it's kind of a small source of tension in the book that builds, and you start to realize that this is actually important, the fact that the two of them can't really be honest with each other. It's one of the things that just fascinates me as a writer, this idea that, you know, if you think about, you know, the people that you love most, how well do you really know them, and how well do you, you know, do you really know, you know, are there secrets that they're keeping? Maybe about something in the past. It might not even be that they deliberately chose to keep a secret from you, but they've decided that they're not going to talk about this episode in their life from before they met you. You know, so they're not lying to you, but they've consciously decided they want to put that in a box and put it away and not talk about it or think about it anymore. And, you know, as we get older, and these characters, the main characters, are sort of in their mid to late 30s. The NYPD detective is in her early 40s. These are people with history. You know, these aren't like on the news who, you know, they're just sort of new to the scene. Like, everybody's carrying baggage. Everybody has had, you know, whether it's the battlefield experiences that Alex and Emily have had, or, you know, in Sharon's case, you know, a, you know, homicide detective, like a, you know, terrific NYPD officer who's been involved in so many cases, and who's had a, like, a kind of a tough family background as well. Like, these people all bring part of, you know, their own story to the case. It's never just about the case that's in front of them. It's also kind of about the burdens that they're carrying and the way that, you know, you're haunted by the past. It was the reason that my editor, she wanted to come up with a name for the series that was different from any of the character names or the book, the book's name. And so that's why, if you look at it online, there's a reference to Shadows of New York. And because we were talking about sort of what, you know, what would be like a hallmark of the series. And I said, I feel like the past is always lurking. Think of it as just like under the surface, like you have a surface of a lake, and just under that surface, though, there are creatures lurking, and you don't see them. There might be a little ripple on the surface from now and then, but you don't actually catch sight of them. And it's only when something bad happens that you do. They feel like, you know, people carry these, you know, your shadow follows you, and you might not acknowledge it. You might not want to think about the past. You might not want to own up to it. But at a certain point, a certain crisis point, you might be forced to. And certainly, you know, this is a book where all of these secrets that people have been holding, they're relevant. And, you know, the book kind of explodes with that at a certain point, at, you know, the weight of these revelations and what people have been keeping from each other.
Well, if the book had no secrets and no flaws, the characters didn't have any flaws, and everything went smoothly, what's the point of a murder mystery?
Right, right. I never like protagonists that are too perfect. I know there are some writers who,
they
you know, write
boring,
terrific
yeah.
books with these sort of flawless, you know, protagonists. And
yeah.
I think, like, my goodness, I don't know anybody like that in real life. And so it, in
no.
a way, it always feels like I can't relate. Like, you know, nobody that I know is that kind of, like, perfect, you know, person. You sort of, I think what helps a reader to connect to a character are those rough edges that you kind of relate to. Like, you see this little bit, there's this bit of familiarity, like, no matter what a character's done, good or bad, you think, like, I can see this, I can understand this, there's maybe something in my experience that I can relate to this, and those rough edges help connect you to a character.
Well, Sharon reminds me of me, because if I want to know something, I'm not going to stop until I get there.
So right.
Yes. She's very tenacious, and she's just like me, and she's very outspoken, and she just says what she wants, and I go, like, yeah, that's me. I get in trouble a lot.
Yeah,
not really.
Yeah.
I do. I just
well,
say what I think, and sometimes I don't realize it. I go, oh, my God, did you really say that? I don't say anything mean, but if somebody aggravates me or something, well, you know what? Oh, well.
Right.
But, yeah. So
but it's
got,
a directness, and even her husband calls her relentless.
Yeah.
Like, and he means it as a compliment.
Yeah.
But her husband,
yes.
you know, talking to her, it's like, you are relentless, and
she
you
is.
Know, that's one of those qualities that can be good and bad, right?
It could get her in trouble. She can go over the edge, and sometimes you see, well, as she was trying to get Alex, and she keeps questioning him and everything, I'm saying, does she have something to prove to herself? Does she want to prove that she's that good, or she really wants to just get the guy? And then we have a character that I really like, which is Corey's best friend, Yasmin. And she thought something was off, too. And we learned something about that Emily was doing that nobody knew that she was doing. Oh, my God. And she could have really,
right.
if that comes out, she can get in trouble. I know.
Yeah, yeah. So you really, you've got, like I say, like all of these characters and their secrets.
Yeah.
Like in Sharon's case, for instance, like that's a good question, because I think it's fair for the reader to say, like, what is she trying to prove? And, you know, in her case, I think she does have this sense of, she has a sense of failure about the case in the past. She actually goes back to talk to her retired partner, the one who worked with her on the Corey Stanton case from a year earlier, because she, you know, she wants to know, like, what did we miss? Like, what did we, you know, the case has haunted her. She carries sort of, she carries guilt around because she feels like Alex Traynor should have been locked up then, and if he had been, you know, his girlfriend would not be missing now. You know, it's kind of like, I knew this was a guy with problems who, you know, capable of some bad things, and I should have done everything back then. The thing is, she did do everything.
Mm-hmm.
She even did some things with the questioning that weren't entirely legal, like things that were sort of, you know, pushing the edge of that envelope. You know, but even with, and she really did do everything, and she wasn't able to make a case stick, but that haunts her because in her mind then she feels responsible. Anyone else that Alex hurts, she feels like that's on me because I didn't put him away back when I knew he should have been put away. And so there's kind of guilt pushing her along where she feels this sense of responsibility. I think you're right that she wants to prove something because she wants to prove that, you know, she knew that this was a ticking time bomb, and because of her own father's experience with PTSD, she's got this, she's got a tremendous fear. kind of realize partway through the book, her partner, her new partner, starts to say, like, he thinks, so you have this vendetta against this guy, you just really hate him. And then he starts to realize partway through, like, you're so sympathetic to this guy, Alex, like, the way you talk about him, you know, it's like someone you care about. And that's when you realize, like, oh, she actually sees elements of her father in him. It's not that she thinks Alex is evil. It's that she, you know, sees what a good person with PTSD, how, you know, they can cause harm without intending to, you know, with just sort of a kind of like going into a bad episode, going, you know, not being fully cognizant of what their surroundings are now, but having flashbacks and feeling that they're threatened, they can harm other people. So you realize, like, oh, it's not really a vendetta. Like, she's so relentless and obsessed with this because she actually identifies with Alex to some extent. So, you know, in some ways, like, she understands what's going on with him better than other people do, because he's not honest with people about his PTSD problems. He tries to minimize it. When CJ is asking him, are you having these PTSD episodes again, he sort of says, like, well, you know, it's getting a little bit bad. And he's not admitting that he's, like, having multiple episodes a day and that things are really going off the rails. And, you know, he's been trying to self-medicate with LSD, and, you know, this is not something that's going very, very well for him, and he needs a lot more help than he's willing to accept, for instance.
Well, before I forget, I don't want to forget, on Tuesday I have the King of Criminal Minds and Law and Order. We have D.P. Lyle with Sunshine State on Tuesday.
Oh, fantastic. I love D.P. Oh, Doug is amazing. I really, really like him.
I've met him a couple
of
times.
A few times. Yeah.
Yeah, I've met him at the
Philofest.
And John Land is doing the new Murder, She Wrote, Murder in Red, Jessica Fletcher, on the 28th. I got lucky.
Oh, fantastic.
Charles Salzberg on the 4th of June of Swans Down. The 6th, this book came to me out of nowhere, and I'm so glad it did. Confessions of an Innocent Man, and the author is David R. Dow. We're going to talk about his take on the death penalty. And he works for he created the Texas Innocent Network, and I can't wait to talk to him. On the 10th, we have The Naming Game by Gabriel Vajon. And June 12th, one of my favorite people in the whole universe, Vincent Zandri, The Caregiver's Wife. The book is terribly scary. On the 17th, I'm doing a panel with 5 noted authors. We're going to talk about Hollywood versus the author. What happens when you give your book to Hollywood and the end result? It's scary. And finally, on the 19th of June, there's a few more after that, Strong Female Characters, with none other than R.G. Belsky, John Land, the King of Criminal Defense, Philip Margolin, and Alan Topol. And that's just some of June. I have 2 more in June, and then I take off the month of July, and I start back in August with Carter Wilson in his new book that just came out. So are you coming to the Thriller Fest this year?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I will be there. I live in New York, actually.
Oh, good.
It's funny because I'm talking to you from Toronto right now just because I'm on book tour, but I live in New York, and so, yeah, so Thriller Fest is always on my calendar. So
I'm
not sure when.
Yeah.
Oh, no, it would be nice to meet you in person, actually. That would be kind of thrilling. One thing I didn't mention is just great to be doing the interview now. So the book, One Small Sacrifice, isn't actually officially out until June 1st, but right now it's an Amazon First Reads book. And so basically anyone who has an Amazon Prime membership can actually download the Kindle edition of the book for free right now until May 31st. So they have a free, like, literally you can get the book for free if you have Amazon Prime. If you don't have Amazon Prime, the First Reads program lets you get the Kindle edition for $1.99 or the hardcover for $9.99. So it is a deal this month, so before it's officially released. So just mention that quickly, because that is kind of a great promotion that they're doing, and I am excited about that.
That is really great. I'm going to post the review on my review site, but I just put a note in my little notepad over here to post the review on June 1st on my thing. I knew that. I said, this is like, it's not out yet. but that's okay. Cause
yeah,
I have it in my little notes.
Yeah, and honestly, whenever whenever you want to, it is wonderful. There are reviews have just started coming out. I actually just got a starred review for the book from Library Journal, so I am over the moon about that. That is just sort of really exciting news. And there are just sort of reviews are just starting to come out. But I appreciate that so much. So yeah,
No, I'm going to post it later. But
if
you look
like posting
at the If you look at the back cover of your book, you've got Sandra Brown, Megan Abbott, I've never read her stuff, Sarah Paretsky, Jeff Abbott, and Chris Holm. And you have the front cover, you have Harlan Coben, whose new book I read,
yes.
Runaway. It's fantastic. I got that, too.
Honestly,
accolades.
Well, what happened? It's really funny because I felt like, oh, my goodness, aim big, aim for, these writers that I really love. I'm going to ask them, to read the book. And but also knowing these are all busy people. I mean, you just mentioned you haven't read Megan Abbott yet, and I adore her work. And it's being adapted for television right now. So she's producing that and writing, and just, these people have crazy schedules. So I reached out to some of my favorite authors who I admire the most, and they all got back to me with blurbs. I mean, I could not believe it.
That's
it actually
great.
Became a running joke with my editor and my agent. They wouldn't even all fit on the cover. They're inside. There's also Lou Burney, Jennifer Hillier, Riley Sager, these terrific writers who took time to read the book and to say lovely things about it. It's funny because I get a little bit emotional about that because I was afraid that, asking 10 people, I would get maybe one, and it would be an honor to have any of them blurb the book because these are phenomenally talented writers, but they all came through. And it's kind I think it's a wonderful comment on the crime fiction community, how generous people
are.
It is
great. I asked Vincent Zandri to read my new one. I don't know what he thinks. Alan Topol gave me accolades. J.D. Holliday did, and a few other people gave me blurbs, little ones. So I'm just hoping that my new publisher, because I just signed a contract with the new publishing place, that they'll get me some more blurbs and some more reviews. I don't know. I don't sit and worry about whether it's 5 stars or whatever, but I think the funniest thing that happened was when I wrote my Faces Behind the Stone series, the first one, I got a lot of 4 stars and fives, and this one girl gave it 2. She said, I didn't understand what the book read, so I stopped reading it. And I said, in that case, I don't consider that this a review. I just consider the fact that you just don't understand what I wrote. That's really too bad. And I don't really care.
But there are people who get upset. I've had on my earlier books, there were people who gave a book 1 star and said, this wasn't delivered when it was supposed to be. And it had nothing to do with the book. It was literally they were mad at something. Yeah, that something wasn't delivered when it was supposed to be. It was as the author, you're sort of sitting there that's a 1-star review. That's bad. But it has nothing to do with you. And so, there's a certain point where you just have to shrug and say, because of the First Reads program, the book is people can review it now on Amazon, and they're reviewing it on Goodreads, and right now it's got 94 reviews on Amazon, and it looks like it has 4.5-star average, which I'm so thrilled about, and I am not going to read the bad reviews. I'm going to
I saw
those right
I see
now.
It
yeah because like
don't even worry about it.
Yeah, well,
people that give you 1 star didn't read
this.
The book. They didn't read the book. That's just their opinion.
Did. I mean, maybe they did and they didn't like it. There's a wonderful quote from Dita Von Teese that I always think of, where she says, "You could be the most luscious, delicious peach in the entire world, and you'll still encounter people who don't like peaches. No matter what you do, there'll be people who don't like it, and that's their right, and that's fine. I don't like it when people are mean and they're complaining about something not being delivered, and they'll take it out on you." And there are going to be people, though, who just don't get what you're doing. And hopefully they will find other books that they love. And your book will end up in the hands of, people who will appreciate it. And, people who will actually find something to relate to in it and who will love it. But, it's a funny age that we're in because now you sort of have people reviewing, and being encouraged to review everything, whether it's, blankets or books. And So you definitely get some interesting responses in that.
I get some interesting responses in general. Lately, it's funny because I post my reviews on my site, Just Reviews. I posted Allison Brennan yesterday, Nothing to Hide.
Oh, she's
and
great.
In five,
yeah.
The book was really scary and good. The ending was surprising. And I posted it, and I posted it on Amazon. And it must have been 3 minutes. And people commented about my review on my site. I go like, if you want to say something nice, that's okay. If you don't like what I wrote, I don't care. They didn't write anything. They just said it was a fantastic review and they liked it. They wanted to read the book. The funniest thing was that I wrote a review about a discography about the 60s, 10 years ago, or something like that. And this guy on Goodreads said, could the review be any longer? I said, well, the author asked me to write everything. I said, so if you don't like it, that's okay. As long as he did, don't worry about it.
That's
and that
so
was my
funny.
Response
like,
to him. I just cracked up laughing. I said, like, they're so ridiculous. I know.
We're in an age where sometimes people feel like they're going to comment on everything. If you don't like that a review is long, then skip over it to the next one. It's really, there's some basic communication stuff that isn't, you know, it's kind of, it's a weird thing for people to do to object, like, wow, that's so long. I mean, what, you don't want a detailed review? Like, I actually love a long, detailed review. So
you're gonna
I just
love
find it
my
funny
review.
That people object to everything. Yeah, oh. No,
you're gonna,
I mean,
you're gonna
the
love my
I
review, but no spoilers.
Review, and I know you won't do it. Right, no spoilers. I always, that upsets me. When someone tries to spoil a book for other people, I hate it. Anytime I've read a review of someone else's book and there's been a spoiler, because then that's taken away something from my experience, you know, when I do get to read the book.
Yeah.
So I, you know, religiously avoid spoilers, but I love long, detailed reviews that are thoughtful and that, you know, sort of grapple with the issues in the book. I appreciate that. I think there's an art to doing that. And, you know, it's too bad if some people don't like that.
Well, that's what they tell me. Because, like I said, as a reading staff developer, I have my master's in reading, my second one. And I learned how to look deeper into the passage and deeper into the book.
Right.
So if there's a message that the author didn't get, they're going to tell me I got it, which is scary, but yeah.
Wow.
And then we have a few more minutes. We have Bobby, the guy he tried to protect the tenants.
Right. Oh, I'm glad we're talking about him.
I love him. There's one character, if you notice, I'm leaving out because he's basically, you know, we don't want to tell who is guilty or anything.
Sure.
So I just crushed him out. So I said, he reminded me of the landlord on Laverne and Shirley. Seriously, that my mother used to watch. Yeah, he reminded me of him because he was sort of like the same kind of guy, or even the one on Three's Company. I'm going like, oh my God.
Oh,
well,
that's funny. Yeah, always hanging around. In that way, I can definitely see that. Like somebody who's sort of always underfoot, and it's a. I should mention it's a lot of the action takes place in a brownstone apartment building. In Hell's Kitchen, so it's only a 5-star building, so this isn't like a, you know, skyscraper building with hundreds of apartments. It's a fairly small setting and fairly intimate setting. There are just a few apartments on each floor, so, you know, the superintendent knows everybody pretty well and, you know, maybe too well. He's definitely, he's a creepy character, but he's, because you spend time with him and you get inside his head, you realize, like, oh, you know, he's gotten into trouble with the police before, not for anything really serious, but, you know, he's got, like, a very minor stash of drugs, you know, just really has some pot around, like he's, you know, not like a hardcore drug addict or something. But, like, he's the kind of guy who's had bad run-ins with the police and is deeply suspicious, you know, that, oh, you know, having police in the building, if I get involved with anything, this is going to come back on me in a bad way. And, you know, it makes him kind of, he does actually lie in a couple of cases to the police. He makes up a story about when he last saw Emily, because he basically was the last person to see her at the building.
Yeah.
But he's got, there's some incriminating stuff around those circumstances, so he's made up a story about running into her on the stairwell, which the police sort of, they know he's a bit of a shady guy, but they accept that story. They don't see, you know, that they they need to doubt that. That's kind of a starting point for the investigation when they're coming up with a timeline of, you know, when people last saw her. And so the fact that he tells these lies to sort of protect himself and just make sure he doesn't get into trouble, it makes investigating the case harder because suddenly you have these, you know, timelines that don't make sense and, you know, the police can't really tell really where the flaw is. They can't, you know, they question Bobby Moore and they try to get the truth out of him and he holds to this story. And so he really does kind of a, he's a little bit, I guess, harmful in without intending to be. You know, he keeps thinking like, oh, you know, I don't want anything bad to happen to Emily. Like, I really like her. She's great. But at the end of the day, like, he wants to protect himself. And so even by telling, like, these sort of small lies about when he last saw her, he really does complicate the investigation. And I think the police would have, you know, they would have solved it much more quickly had it not been, you know, for Bobby's interference. But because he's made up stories and, you know, he's kind of giving them what he wants. He's giving them, like, great detail and, oh, exactly, you know, tiny little bit of conversation and maybe pointing them, you know, in the direction of other people. You know, he really does sort of a disservice that way. But at the same time, the reader really understands, and I don't want to get into spoilers, but you also see that Bobby isn't entirely, terrible. And he does have a character arc where, you know, as he gets towards the end of that and he realizes that things have gone really badly, he does want to redeem himself. So even this character who, you know, he's not the best intentioned character, he's maybe not the kindest character, but there is, you know, there is a heart beating inside his chest and he does have a sense of, you know, what the right thing is to do. So even a more minor character like that, they still have an important role to play in the book.
Well, that's true, because sometimes you lose it with too much on the main characters, and you wonder, well, you know, these minor characters sometimes make the book. So
yes.
We got a few more,
yeah, exactly.
Four more minutes. Yeah, they do. Yeah, he did. But you brought in some.
I'm so glad to hear that. I'm really glad that you liked that. That's great.
Yeah, I did. I said, like, yeah. But there's another connection that really got me, too. I grew up in the Bronx. I don't live in the Bronx anymore, but I grew up in the Bronx. So Woodlawn Cemetery and Riverdale and, yeah, and all of these areas. I grew up in the South Bronx on Southern Boulevard and Shima.
Okay. Yeah.
And I went to school there. And I grew up there, and that's what makes you tough, people, let me tell you. And
wow.
So
yeah.
What role does the car play, her car play, and why did you decide to pick my borough, the Bronx?
Oh, I love the Bronx. I feel like the Bronx is the borough that does not get enough love. Like, everyone knows about Manhattan, right? And everyone, though,
yeah,
you know, crushing on Brooklyn, you know, known for all this stuff. And Queens is coming up. Like, there's this increased appreciation for Queens. And I love the Bronx. Like, there's so much there and people don't know it. Back in my travel writing days, I did a book called New York City Day by Day for Frommer's. And one of the things I did was sort of, I was looking for unexplored areas and areas that tourists didn't normally go to. And I ended up spending a lot of time in the Bronx because there was such amazing stuff up there. Even like Woodlawn Cemetery is one of the most beautiful places in the entire city. And it's easy to get to. You know, you can just like take, it's like a number 4 train, you know, drops you off at its doorstep. And, you know, just wandering through there, it's scenic, it's beautiful. So I feel like the Bronx never gets enough love. And even like my first book, The Damage Done, a good chunk of it was also set in the Bronx because I feel this appreciation. Like, it's this gorgeous, wonderful, amazing place. I mean, rich people, poor people, there's, you know, tough areas in the Bronx. There's a lot of toughness there because it has been, you know, underserved and doesn't get its due. But that, to me, is a place that I want to write about. And actually, the two areas that come up most in the book, you've got Hell's Kitchen, which is where the, you know, Midtown North Precinct is and where Alex and Emily live and, you know, where several of the characters live. And Hell's Kitchen is another area that's sort of like it's got, you know, kind of a rough past, and that fascinates me. So, yeah, so that was why, so the character of Alex grew up in the Bronx, and a childhood friend of his you know, also from the Bronx, who now lives in Manhattan but inherited his mother's house, you know, he's like a big part of the book as well. And the investigation kind of more and more starts to move into the Bronx. The car that you mentioned quickly is one of those things that pops up on the radar. Emily and Alex don't have a car, but it turns out that Emily would borrow her brother's car. Her brother lives in San Francisco and just sort of lets her use this. And at a certain point in the book, and I don't think it's spoilery to say it because it happens fairly early, but the police find the car in the Bronx and they find blood in the trunk. And it's one of those moments, that's really the moment where they realize that the stories that they've collected from the suspects and the witnesses, nothing adds up because, you know, any narrative that they've had from Alex, narrative that they've had from Bobby, the superintendent, a few other people that I won't name because we haven't talked about them.
I just crossed them out.
Right. And, you know, suddenly they're finding the car that Emily used with blood in the trunk, and they test it, and it is Emily's blood. And it sort of blows up the investigation to that point because they found some blood in the apartment, but it was a small amount of blood. You know, like I've cut myself and, you know, like any who hasn't done this, like cut themselves with a kitchen knife or something. You find a small amount of blood in an apartment. That's not suggestive of anything. But what they find in the car is suggestive of something really bad. And so, but it also, it means that, you know, they know that people are lying to them and that there's like more to this case than just, you know, someone disappearing. So, yeah, so it's one of those things that, like, a clue that comes up that, you know, it changes everything.
This is very true. We have about 2 minutes. So what is next? When am I getting it? And you bring Sharon back. And I know she's got a new partner, Raphael. And, yeah, so are you going to keep him with her? Because
so,
I liked him. I liked him, too.
Yeah, yeah. He's in the next book, too. Actually, in the next book, you're going to get some of Raphael's perspective. So in this book, because he's just transferred in. He's from Los Angeles. He has a very, you know, Sharon's really driven and very forward. And Raphael is more laid back, and he's, you know, there's a funny side. He's a little quiet, but he's definitely like a sort of witty kind of funny guy.
Mm-hmm.
So the next book is called Don't Look Down.
Nice.
It's written now. I'm in the middle of edits for it. Don't have a cover yet, but my understanding is it's going to come out in the first quarter of 2020. So.
Oh, nice.
Less than a year from now, which I'm excited about. You will absolutely get the book early. I will promise you
right now.
Definitely get an early copy of that. Sharon will be back. Her partner, Raphael, will be back. But it's an entirely new story with a different cast of characters, and you will have, you know, a different close third-person relationship with some of the suspects in this story, too. So it's exciting because the story sort of told in a similar way, and there's you know, familiar characters come back to it, but then it'll be entirely new as well. So,
exciting.
I'm kind of realizing, like, as much as it's, you know, tough to tell the story in this way, it lets it be fresh. Each book feels a little bit like a standalone because the case itself is a new case and you get new characters in it. So, thank you. Yeah,
well,
I will absolutely make sure that you get
too.
That.
Don't worry.
I like characters
that
are
you going
to
be using
yeah.
Megan? Is she going to be your publicist, Megan? Are you going to be using the same one from Thomas Mercer, I hope?
Hopefully. I mean, Thomas and Mercer arranged all of that for me. She's been terrific to work with.
She's better than
so
terrific.
So hopefully that'll... Yeah, I love her. Like, she really, really does amazing work. So my hope is certainly that, you know, they will be doing that going forward. All of it was arranged through Thomas and Mercer, so I, you know, didn't set it up myself. But I really hope to be working with her going forward because I think she's phenomenal.
I'll tell her.
I just emailed her
and told her that this was a great interview. She sent me Murmur of the Bees by a brand new Mexican author, and she didn't tell me she was sending it. And I said, okay. And then she said, okay, what day do you have left in June for an interview? I gave her the last one. The very last one.
Oh,
then
wow.
I had read Eternally Emily, and Emily is a artificial consciousness, not artificial intelligence. It's probably one of the scariest books I ever read. And then I said to the publicist, okay, June 26th is the last day of June, and you got to put him on my schedule because I got to know how he figured this one out. And I very rarely ask for an anybody's interview, but I thought, oh my God, this is great. So I want to thank
That's
you
amazing.
A million times. Thank you so very much.
Thank you so much. Oh my goodness, I'm so delighted to talk to you. Thank you for your wonderful questions and for your thoughtful questions. Like, it was, you know, wonderful to talk about the book in depth. I really appreciate you having me on the show.
Thank you so much, everybody. It's a beautiful day outside, and I'm going to post your review later. And I will send the link to Megan so that you could read my brilliance, I hope.
Amazing. I am looking forward to it. Thank you so much.
Okay, everybody have a great day, and bye.
Okay, thank you. Bye-bye.